Oh, no, I never uploaded the audio from last week. I apologize. I got caught up doing Anna Maria finals. My semester has been so off. I teach at two colleges. The other college is 2 weeks ahead of you guys. Started 2 weeks early. Finished 2 weeks early. Just craziness. But I'll get the audio up today. I also, as I said on Wednesday, I'm going to give you a video to watch. I went and listened to the previous recording that I had on YouTube, and it sounded like crap. So I'm going to re-record it today. I tried doing it over the weekend, but I was busy raising money for good causes.
Is today the last time we're showing up to class?
Yes, today is the last class day. But I'm going to give you a video on the bureaucracy, and that's going to be the last bit for the final. All right, so we're doing parties. We got through all, oh no, actually we didn't get through all that. Crap, we ran out of time because we ended up there. All right, close, slideshow, current. All right. Political parties has nothing to do with Vietnam. That's another class. Elections. We've done elections. Where's the parties? Parties. All right. Party systems. Every single country that is a supposed democracy, the phrase that they bandy about, has some form of party system, meaning there are organized political parties like our political parties, meaning they're organized, they raise money, they run candidates, and their goal is to win office. But obviously, party systems vary. Not just country from country, but also over time within the country. For example, our political parties today are different than they were just 2-3 decades ago. Yes, we had the Democrats. Yes, we've had the Republicans going all the way back to the 1850s. But the Republican Party of today is not the same Republican Party of 20 years ago. Just like the Democrat Party today is not the Democrat Party of 20 years ago. Just on ideology alone, the modern Democrat Party has gone way far to the left. They've pretty much driven out all of the centrists. And the weird thing is many of the centrist Democrats have switched over and become, I don't know if you want to call them MAGA supporters, but they've gone over to the Republican Party. That's one of the reasons why Trump won. Because believe it or not, Trump is not a Democrat. Trump was never a Democrat. I'm sorry, a Republican. Trump was always a Democrat his whole life. And many of the policies which he's pushing would be the policies of JFK or Harry Truman. You know, the Democrats from decades ago. The traditional Republican Party was more like the George Bush Party. But those people, they don't really have a place in the modern Republican Party. So, even though we've had the same labels, the behavior, the supporters, the ideology of our political parties have changed over time.
So, when did the term... If we look at Bush as like the example of the, I don't want to say traditional conservatism, but you know, real conservatism compared to what we're doing today, when did the term neocon come about, and who does it best apply to?
The neocons represent the Democrats who were like the war hawks that joined and supported Nixon. Mm-hmm. So you're literally talking George H.W. Bush. You know, he would have been somebody like that. You know, neocon or the Dick Cheneys.
So much.
Right. These were the people that were motivated to use the power of the United States, not for classical conservative ideals, but in order to exploit our position globally. So they're not really necessarily true conservatives. So, yeah, they want to give tax cuts, but at the same time, they want to use our war powers to basically expand America's position globally. Which, if you're going to cut the spending of the government, but then you're going to spend on war, how is that a conservative?
That's just what I hear applied mostly to Bush and Iraq.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, classic example. Bush, W. Bush, Cheney, all those guys. Rumsfeld. Absolutely. All right. How do you tell a party? Well, again, like I said, you can look at any country that is a so-called democracy and just look at who runs for elections. You can tell the difference between party systems based on the number of parties or the size of parties. Is it an election where there's major parties and minor parties? You also can look at the extent to which the parties control their actual candidates. Interestingly enough, in our country, a candidate needs the support of the political party to get money, but candidates are basically free to go rogue on what positions they're for. And they're also allowed to change their positions. I'll give you an example of Fetterman, Senator Fetterman from Pennsylvania. He is seemingly continually going against what the party, the Democrat Party, wants in terms of stances. But as he said repeatedly, I'm a Democrat, but I also have to look out for my constituents. And he implies that means I have to be bipartisan. I have to reach across the aisle to get things for my own people. But then you have some people who are complete ideologues that only follow the ideology of the party. Someone like Alexandria Cortez, AOC. Someone like that. She's an ideologue. So, again, I'm just talking about it in just generalized political science terms. It's not that you necessarily need to know any of the characters. I'm just trying to give you examples just to make sense of it. All right. What creates a political system? The nation that you're talking about, the country you're talking about. The times in which we're talking about. Are there cultural factors that are involved? What are the laws? What are the rules? How does one get selected to run for office? Again, one of the weird things about our system, where we have primaries, is that in our system, this applies to both the Democrats and the Republicans, is that in order to win in a primary, you have to go to the farthest extent on the ideology of whichever party you're talking about. So Democrat has to go hard left, Republican has to go hard right to win the primary, but then when they get to the general, they're supposed to somehow change gears completely and go back to the center. Now, in recent elections, that has not been the case. Trump did not deviate. Kamala did not deviate. Biden did not deviate. They went hard left and they stayed hard left. And obviously, it helped Biden in 2000, but it didn't help Kamala in 2024. It didn't help Trump in 2020, but it helped him in 2024. So what's going to happen the next time around? I don't know. Trump truly has been a game changer. And I'm not saying in a good way, I'm not saying in a bad way. He's just been so out of the norm. He has been the exception that I don't know what's going to happen next time around. We might swing back to go more traditional. Now, an interesting comparison is what takes place in our country versus what takes place in most of the other countries on Earth. Again, the so-called democracies. In the United States, in most elections, whoever gets the most votes wins. They don't even need a majority. They can win with a plurality. It just comes down to who gets the most votes. And they are the only one who gets access to government. So if you win, you're in, and there's nothing for second place. In Europe, elections are based on percentages. So if you ever hear about like a parliamentary election in Germany or a parliamentary election in England, people go and they vote, not for candidates, but they vote for the party. And the party chooses the delegates. So like if you're going to vote for Labour, why are you going to vote for Labour? Well, you believe in the position of that party. So I go to the polls, I vote for Labour. Labour, if they get 15% of the vote, then gets to pick whatever 15% of the delegates are. The party names the people, not the voters. The thing about proportional representation, it means that small parties can get access to government. It's next to impossible in a proportional representation system for one party to get a majority, because you could have 10 parties running. In our system, you can have a majority. The Republicans control the federal government right now. They control both chambers of Congress, they control the White House, and generally speaking, they control the Supreme Court. Could it change? Yes, but it depends upon the next election. In a proportional system, you could never get one party having a majority, so they have to create a coalition. They have to make an alliance. And I don't remember if it was Spain or if it was Germany, one of the European countries, they had an election and the party with the most votes, so had the highest percentage, still wasn't a majority, they were not allowed to pick the prime minister. Usually it's whoever gets the most votes gets to pick the prime minister. Why? Well, there was a coalition of the losing parties that got together and outvoted the winner. So it's complicated. It's complicated. But at the very least, if you know what happens in our system, then it's easy for you individually, if you see something in the news, to just kind of compare and contrast it. All right, questions? All right. Culture also plays a role. Culture plays a big role. What are the attitudes of the people? Are the voters mostly centrists? Or do their political views go to one extreme or the other? Are they responsive to single-issue parties? There are some parties across the world that literally organize behind one issue. That's it. Whatever their cause is. Or do the voters like having more like an a la carte sense? You know, maybe instead of supporting just one, well, I kind of like that party because they're there for that, but ooh, look at this other party. You know, do the voters make a decision impulsively when they go in and vote? Or do voters identify themselves as part of a party and thus remain completely loyal to them? I'll be honest with you. In my whole life, I've only voted for one Democrat. And I've been voting since the 1980s. Only voted for one. And I only know he was local because he was running as a state rep. Never voted for any other Democrat. Only because I don't support the Democrat Party in Massachusetts. But that doesn't mean I always vote for the Republican. There have been Republican candidates on the ballot that I have not voted for because I did not like who they were, what they stood for. So I am a registered Republican, but I don't identify myself as a Republican. Because at the end of the day, I reserve the right to vote for whoever I think best aligns with my values. Why don't I go independent? I don't know. When I was a kid and I registered to vote, I registered as a Republican. I just haven't changed it. Maybe someday I'll go unenrolled. But I just haven't had the need yet. So FYI,
I voted for George Bush in 2000, but I did not vote for him until 2004. I wrote in Donald Duck. Or Mickey Mouse or somebody. So the same is true in most countries. Do the voters view themselves as part of the party, or are they just kind of voting for the party? And are they 100% loyal to the party, or do they vote for whoever they think is the best candidate? You know, it's you can't get hardcore data, because as you all know, your attitudes change on a daily basis. There might be something that you really like, but then you get burnt out on it, and then suddenly you just don't want it anymore. Voters are the same way across the globe. Now, one last point. There is not a single elective system on earth that requires there be political parties. That's true about our system. When the framers made our Constitution, think about it, it went into effect before there were actually organized parties. The first few presidential elections, the first few congressional elections, people were voting for the men whose name were on the ballot. They weren't voting for the political party. If the Democrats went away and the Republicans went away, our system would function fine. And the best example that I can give you is Massachusetts municipal elections. The elections that take place in your town or your city. Those are not partisan elections. You don't see Democrat or Republican next to the candidate. You just see the candidate's name. So in a sense, you are voting for the person based on what you heard about them or based on interactions that you may have had. I can tell you in Sutton, a lot of people in town like me. But there are people who don't. And how do I know? Well, I can tell you just based on the conversations that I've had, like when I've gone to the transfer station, or I went to the one, we call it the center store. It's like a gas station in the center of town where they make sandwiches. Or I go to the grocery store. I get this all the time. My wife hates it. Hey, Jesse, I hear this a lot. And then sometimes people just chew me out and they yell at me. You know, okay, it comes with the territory. But every single election that I've won based on who I am, not because of the fact that I'm a Republican. And I can tell you, I got a lot of people in my town who are Democrats that will support me, just because of what I do in the office. So, on a national level, we could erase the Democrats. We could erase the Republicans. In fact, to be honest with you, I wish people voted that way. I hate it. Oh, I'm a Democrat, so I'm going to vote for the Democrat. Or I'm a Republican, I'm going to vote. No. Look at the individual candidate. Try to figure out where they stand on everything and make a decision based on what's best for you. Not just because there's a D or an R. Questions? All right, let's hit the American party system. Now, in the United States, the parties in our country consist of a coalition. There's a small national entity. And the national entity has loose-knit alliances with state-level party affiliates. And the state-level party affiliates have loose-knit alliances with the local party or the county party affiliates. So just like our federalist system is made up of the U.S. government, the state governments, the county governments, the town governments, the parties are structured the same way. Now, of course, that does not mean that the Worcester Democrat City Committee
agrees with everything that the Massachusetts Democrat Party agrees with. And in the same sense, that means the Massachusetts Democrat Party doesn't necessarily agree with everything that comes from the DNC,
the Democrat National Committee. But again, it's this loose-knit coalition based on brand identification. That's a good way to explain it.
Now, even though we did not have a party out of the gates, traditionally,
we've had two parties. We've had a two-party system. Why? Well, it came down to us versus them, you versus me. As we know, on one hand, you had Jefferson, you had Madison that believed in states' rights. And then you had Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the leading proponents for a stronger national government. That's really where the two-party system came out of. So Jefferson and Madison worked hard to gather supporters at the state level and the local level. And they organized what generally is referred to as the Democrat-Republican Party. Whereas Hamilton, pushing for a stronger U.S. government, was instrumental in organizing what would become the Federalist Party. And those two parties began doing what modern parties do today. They, for instance, had newspapers, and they printed stories that supported their positions. They tried recruiting candidates to run under their brand. Of course, they didn't really do fundraising because most of the people that ran for office back then were wealthy because they didn't have to go to work. They could afford to take time off and actually go serve in office. But again, you can see a lot of what today happens out of the gates. And the candidates that chose to align themselves ran against the positions of the other party. So the Democrat-Republicans ran against the Federalists. The Federalists ran against the Democrat-Republicans. From the organization of the Democrat-Republicans and the Federalists, you saw the Federalist Party implode. You saw the Democrat-Republican Party split into factions, which of course included the Democrats and the Whigs, and there was the Know-Nothing Party, which was an anti-Catholic party, and there were some other national parties that kind of came and went. But when the Republican Party organized in the 1850s, really since then, up to today, as we know, it's pretty much been the D's versus the R's. Although, again, the Republicans in the 1850s are very different than the Republicans in 2025. FYI, the Republican Party actually started off as a single-issue party. Does anyone know what their original platform was about?
Anti-slavery.
Yeah, anti-slavery. It was an abolitionist party. They organized to stop the spread of slavery after the Great Compromise of 1850. Now here's a question that gets asked frequently. Why do we only have two? Why don't we have three? Why don't we have four? Well, most political scientists believe there are two factors that explain why two. The first,
because the Democrats and the Republicans have controlled power for so long, guess who's made all the election rules?
Guess who's established all of the requirements? You know, it's been the D's and the R's. So they've intentionally made it difficult for a third party to emerge, not only on a state level, but on a national level. I mean, after all, to get a candidate on the ballot, you have to collect signatures. And sometimes you have to collect thousands, if not tens of thousands of signatures just to get the candidate's name on the ballot. How are you going to get those signatures if you don't have a staff? If you don't have volunteers? If you don't have brand recognition? And state rules often require that third-party candidate to get a certain percentage of the vote so the party can stay on the ballot. And guess what happens if they don't get that percentage? The party ceases to be. So the best example that I can give you was the effort of Evan Falchuk. Back in 2014, he tried creating a new third party in Massachusetts, which was called the United Independent Party. He went and spoke on college campuses for 2 years before 2014 to get volunteers, to get college kids to want to work to create a new party in Massachusetts. Those volunteers spent countless hours getting signatures. They managed to get enough signatures to get Evan's name on the ballot. So he ran for governor in 2014. He managed to get 7% of the vote, which meant that the party could stay registered at least until the next election. But fast forward to 2018, Evan didn't want to run again. He couldn't get anyone to run. I think in the midterms of 2016, I think he got two people to run for the state house, and like they didn't even get like more than 2% of the vote. So all of his efforts for 2 years basically imploded. So 2018 rolls around, the United Independent Party ceases to be. I read there is currently another effort in Massachusetts to get a third party. And it's made up of a loose-knit coalition of, call them rhinos or neocons, as well as disenfranchised Democrats in Massachusetts. So it's very possible at the next state election, which is 2 years from now, we might see another attempt to create a third party. I forget what they're called. I don't think it's like the Third Way, or I don't remember what they call it, but they're going to try again. Will they be successful? They might be able to get on the ballot, but of course the true test is if can they sustain it. All right, so factor number one, just the system, the rules work against getting a third party. And the second factor is our culture.
Our culture. Say what you want about Americans, but we have a tendency to be very simplistic in the sense that it's us versus them. You know, good guys and the bad guys. We generally don't have the ability to kind of see the different shades of gray, as it were.
So, it's easy for us to identify with one party and view the other as the adversaries, as opposed to do what I suggested before, that the best thing we could do as voters is not identify as a party,
but rather look at the individual candidates.
Questions? All right. Well, what about third parties in America? Well, ironically, while third parties have not been successful in terms of winning elections, they have actually often played key roles in U.S. politics. Why? Third parties often raise issues which the major parties are unwilling or unable to confront. So, as we said, for example, the Republican Party was established as an abolitionist party. Why? Well, the Democrat Party in the 1850s was pro-slavery, and the Whig Party wasn't necessarily pro-slavery, but they weren't anti-slavery. They were more content not to touch it. So, there was a group of radical people who were opposed to slavery, so they organized the Republican Party. Believe it or not, one of the big starting points was actually in Worcester. Worcester was a hotbed of abolitionist activity. So the goal was to stop the spread of slavery into the U.S. territories. But as that became more and more popular in the free states, the Republicans began to absorb the Whigs. And ultimately, that's what allowed for the Republicans to become a national party by the time of the 1860 election. And how did that turn out? Well, the first Republican candidate to run in a presidential election won elective office. Abraham Lincoln. So not only do they raise important issues, but sometimes they achieve success by merging into one of the major parties. So, for example, the Progressive Party, which was actually organized by Teddy Roosevelt in the 1912 election, although it was often initially called the Bull Moose Party. Well, TR created the party after winning the majority of the Republican primaries. But the party basically said, no, we want Taft. Taft is the incumbent president. We're going to name Taft. So TR got pissed, marched out of the Republican convention, and declared he's making the Progressive Party. He drafted the Progressive Platform. He called for minimum wage. He called for an 8-hour workday. He called for Social Security. He called for workers' comp. He called for the creation of a death tax. Teddy Roosevelt was not a conservative. He was a progressive. And what ended up happening? Well, he ran in 1912, and he split the Republican vote. And as a consequence, Woodrow Wilson won. Well, after that election, the Progressive Party continued as a separate party into the 1920s, but it would eventually be absorbed into the Democrat Party. And by the 1920s, the Democrat Party began advocating for those ideals that were advocated by Teddy Roosevelt. And if you study American history, they were also the primary focus of Roosevelt's cousin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the New Deal that was implemented after he won in the presidential election of 1932. So they raise issues. Sometimes they embed themselves into parties and change the party from within. Sometimes they act as spoilers. I already told you, TR split the vote. By the way, if TR did not win in 1912, Taft would have won overwhelmingly. But of course, TR had a huge ego. He believed that he was right in this moral crusade, but the consequence is he got one of the most vile people as a person into the White House, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, when he became president, he set back race relations back decades. He was a huge segregationist.
Didn't just do that. KKK film in
the
White House?
He did. He actually did. He also was the one that ordered that all U.S. military forces when they went over to fight in World War I, be segregated. And he went so far, there was a black, I can't remember the exact unit, and I apologize, but there was a significant unit of black soldiers that were more than capable fighters. And Woodrow Wilson basically said, well, we don't want him with the American boys, so he gave him over to the French. He reallocated American division of black soldiers to the French. And by the way, they won proportionally more meritorious awards than any other unit that had fought, because they went in with an attitude. You know, look at this, we're Americans and our own army doesn't want us. They went and kicked the crowd's ass. So yeah, not a good dude. Not a good dude by any means.
The worst president, I think.
Now, I'm not going to say he was the worst, but he's definitely in the top five. I would put the worst as either Biden or Buchanan, James Buchanan.
Maybe on what they, I'm just saying personally, like I don't think Biden was as evil.
No, I'm talking worst in terms of destruction of our country.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, he allowed how many millions of illegal immigrants to come in?
Right.
Yeah. He spent more money than any other president proportionally in the history of our country, put us more in debt.
Which is crazy because he was only a single termer.
I know. Yeah, absolutely. Plus, it's possible he actually wasn't even president.
Yeah.
All right. Other instances of spoilers besides TR. Ross Perot. Ross Perot is the man single-handedly responsible for allowing Bill Clinton to become president in 1992. That was a weird race. I remember when that race happened. Ross Perot was a multi-millionaire. I forgot what company he owned, but he just decided that he was going to run kind of like a Trump, you know, as a businessman who wanted to get in there and bring business attitudes to government. And he used his money, and he bought ad time. So, like, you'd tune on at, like, 8 o'clock at night, and there would be Ross Perot. And he'd sit there, and he had, like, a high, squeaky voice, and he had charts. And he'd talk about, you know, government spending, we got to cut the spending because it's not right that our great-great-great-grandchildren are going to have to pay for this money. And it was bizarre. But Ross Perot managed to take enough Republican votes away from George H.W. Bush that allowed Bill Clinton to not only win in 1992, but Ross Perot reared his head again in 1996. And allowed Clinton to win re-election against Bob Dole. In 2000, George H.W. Bush ekes out a win in Florida, 537 votes. How is that possible? Well, Ralph Nader ran as a third party. He was part of the Green Party. Had he not been in the race, many of the Florida Democrats would have voted for Gore. And Al Gore would have won in 2000. By the way, Clinton supporters in 2016 claim that Jill Stein did the same thing against Hillary Clinton. Trump won in 2016 because he beat Hillary by some 50,000 votes. Well, Jill Stein got 70,000 votes in Pennsylvania. Had her name not been on the ballot, those voters likely would have voted for Clinton, which meant Hillary Clinton could have won. So, 2020. It happened again in 2020. Joe Jorgensen, who was a libertarian, he ran in 2020 and he took, libertarian votes, who tend to be center-right, away from Trump in Arkansas, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin in 2020. So had he not been on the ballot, Trump might have won in 2020. You know, so they haven't won, but they definitely impact elections. Sorry for the crash. All right, questions? Oh, there we go. There's all the names. T.R., Perot, Nader, Stein. You don't need to know those things. Yeah. All right. So we have two parties. We've had the same two for most of our country's history. We know why we've had two. We know that there have been third parties. We know what third parties have done. But here's might be an interesting statement for you. Unlike other political parties in other countries, our two major parties are actually weak. They've had staying power by adapting to the times. But in terms of the party's ability to control the narrative, the message, they have been weak in comparison to their global peers. Most political scientists associate this weakness coming from two principal factors. The first, do I have it as a click? I do not. The first is that our constitutional systems. The constitutional systems that we have at the national and state level. We have separation of power. We have checks and balances. In order for a party to actually control the process, they have to not only control the Congress, both chambers, the White House, the Supreme Court, but they also have to control the vast majority of federal courts, all the way down to the district court level. And they have to control the states. And they have to control the governor. They have to control the state legislatures. They have to control the state courts. And then they have to control the county governments. And then they have to control the municipal governments. We have never had a single party that has been able to do that. Because there's so many different seats that are available. It always gives the other party a chance to potentially pull off a win. So, if they can't control anything, well, what if they have most? Well, don't forget, we have parliamentary maneuvers. The most the easiest one to remember is when we talked about the filibuster in the Senate. Unless a party has a veto-proof majority in the Senate, the minority party can basically stifle legislation by talking it to death. In our state government, under the Golden Dome on Beacon Hill, they have the filibuster as well. But the Democrats in our state have an overwhelming supermajority, a veto-proof majority. So unless voters in our state give, I think, 30% of the seats, no, it's 35% of the seats, to the Republicans where they can force a roll call, we're never going to be able to really have checks and balances in our state. The other factor that explains why our political parties are weak, not only the system itself, but the election process. Who decides who runs in the general election? Well, it's the people. The people are going to vote based on the primaries. Well, what happens if the candidate that wins is not the candidate that the party wants? Doesn't matter. You know, when we implemented the primary system throughout the 20th century, that was put in there to basically negate the power that the party had over the candidates. So now, you could have somebody like, a good example that I can give you is Barack Obama in 2008. This may be a shock to you, but in 2008, most of the Democrat voters in the primaries voted for Hillary Clinton. They did not want Barack Obama. But of course, the party intervened because the Democrats have superdelegates. And so that's the reason why Obama ended up getting nominated at the convention and ran in the general. But do you think the Republican Party wanted Trump in 2016 or 2020? 2024, he had taken over the party by then. But in 2016, the Republican Party did not want Trump at all. So they worked to basically defeat him. But the people voted, and Trump got nominated in 2016, and eventually he would take the White House. So because the parties are negated by our system, and because the parties don't basically pick who runs in elections, our political parties today are decentralized. So they're kind of bottom up as opposed to top down. And in order to win, because there's only two, you have to have broad coalitions. So for the Republicans to win in 2026, in the midterms, they're going to have to keep Trump's coalition together, which includes blue-collar workers, union members, Second Amendment advocates, evangelicals, disenfranchised black and minority voters who are, you know, more conservative religiously, socially. In order to win, they'll have to keep that team together. And by the way, not all of those factions necessarily see eye to eye on everything. On the Democrat, and again, I'm not trying to be negative, but where the Democrats have gone, I don't see how they're going to be successful on a large scale, because they've basically focused on more of the activists, and they've lost the support of the common, everyday, average, you know, worker. But you have the LBG advocates, you have the socialists, you know, you have, you know, the people that are advocating for the illegal immigrants. You know, that seems to be the Democrat coalition today. But again, unless they can go to the center, the vast majority of American people don't want that stuff. But I don't know. You know, the interesting thing about our politics is every single election cycle, the parties kind of reinvent themselves. And they have to in order to stay legitimate. So as I said, one of the biggest things is that in order for the parties to be successful is they can't be closed-minded. And I think that is also something that has hurt the Democrat Party. Again, Trump was a Democrat his whole life. Tulsi Gabbard was a Democrat. Joe Rogan was a Democrat. RFK Jr., Democrat. Well, all of those people were driven out of the Democrat Party because they didn't toe the party line. But where did they end up? In the Republican Party, because the Republican Party was trying to be a Big Ten. Have a couple of core ideas, and then everyone else can believe what they want to believe. Will that change? Yeah, I'm sure it will. In 2026, 2028. As I said previously, this traditionally was the path. Bill Clinton, good example. Bill Clinton, 1992, relatively unknown figure nationally, governor of Arkansas, managed to win the presidency by not focusing on any social issues, but only by focusing on the economy. The bread and butter issues. Taxes, standards of living, things like that. Plus, George H.W. Bush kind of shot himself in the foot when at the 1988 nominating convention, he actually said to the delegates, you know, read my lips. You know, as president, I will not vote or there will be no new taxes. I forget exactly how he phrased it. Well, in the 1992 presidential election, guess what Clinton put in most of his ads? That one little snippet. What ended up happening when George H.W. Bush was president? He actually had to vote to raise taxes because we went and fought Saddam Hussein. We went and fought the Gulf War. In order to pay for the war, he had to raise taxes. But you know what Clinton didn't run on? He didn't run on gun control. He didn't run on health care. He didn't run on LGBTQ issues. He didn't run on any of the social stuff. Just the economy.
Because at the end of the day, I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican or independent, as I've said many times, we all kind of believe the same basic things. We want to be able to go to work. We want to be able to take home enough money to take care of ourselves and our families.
And traditionally, that's what candidates have been for when they've run. And I've also talked about this a couple of times. Today, more and more people are basically unenrolling. And I've already told you, look at Massachusetts. There are more people who are unenrolled than Democrats and Republicans combined. Because the weird thing is, again, Massachusetts just doesn't make sense to me. People don't want to be a Democrat or a Republican, but they continue to re-elect Democrats. And then when you look at the polls, people in Massachusetts generally are not happy with the direction that the state is going in, but we keep putting the same people back in. What's the definition of insanity? Keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. But it hasn't impacted the national level yet. Well, actually, it's not true. Maybe it did this past time around, 2020. Because I'm sure, again, Trump won in the popular vote. I'm sure a lot of the people that went and voted for Trump might not necessarily view themselves as Republicans. But they voted for him based on maybe looking at the other candidate and saying, oh my God, that would be a disaster if we allowed her to get it after the last 4 years. So what's going to happen the next time around? Are those same people going to vote Republican? Probably not. Because they weren't necessarily voting for the Republican brand. They were voting for Trump. So what's the Republican Party going to do? Are they going to try to clone Trump and make another Trump-like candidate? And if they do that, will he be as successful as Trump? Or are they going to focus on like the MAGA? So the platform, you know, don't know. And then again, the question always has to be asked, what are the Democrats going to do to counter it? Can the Democrats get the independence back? Don't know. Don't know. But that's the fun of politics. Politics have to be viewed through history. Yes, politics are the here and now. But in order to understand how we got here, you have to look at what has happened previously. All right, questions. All right. I've already talked about this, so I'm not necessarily going to worry about this too much. I told you basically there's the national level. There's also the state and local. I don't necessarily care about this. I don't think I have any questions on the exam about that. But I do have questions about party activities, so we'll skip down to that because I'm watching the time.
The primary activity of a party, like we said on last class, was to win elections. That's the primary goal. To put candidates into the field and to win elections. Because if they don't win elections, they cannot remain viable. So, there are five things that political parties do. The first is they support the nomination of candidates. They support the nomination of candidates. Sometimes they go out and recruit candidates. I was actually asked in 2014 to run for the state house as a state rep. Put my name up. I ran in the primary. Came in second out of three. C'est la vie. I wasn't a good Republican mass GOP candidate, I guess. But someone came out and found me. I was on the school committee. They found me based on how popular I was in my town, because I was one of the few people on the school committee that basically said, you know, the schools shouldn't be spending and spending and spending, because if the schools continue to spend and spend and spend, what about the seniors that are living on fixed incomes? You know, they can't afford the increase in the property taxes, and are we going to drive seniors who've lived in town for 20, 30, 40, 50 years out of town to give a teacher a raise?
In Webster, they had this meeting where, like, they had a vote on if they wanted to put, like, a new high school. Everybody said no, but they just did it anyways.
They can't. In order to do what's called a debt exclusion, when you're going to build a project like that, it has to go to town meeting. And if town meeting votes against it, it's dead. Because if town meeting doesn't vote for it, it can't go on the ballot. Because town meeting is the legislative branch. Town meeting decides on spending. So maybe town meeting voted for it, and then it went to the voters. And maybe the voters voted against it.
They also got like a grant for it too.
Well, the state offers like 30 or 40% funding for schools. But if they're going forward with it, that meant that both town meeting and the voters had to support it. But just because they voted down one time doesn't stop them from coming back and do it again. All right, parties also do fundraising. Oh, and I combined two. Fundraising, and the third one is attracting and keeping voter loyalty. If you make a donation to a political party, even if you only make one, chances are you'll get on their voting list, their email list, and you'll get invitations to fundraisers, where you can go and you can spend like, oh, I'm going to make a $25 donation, and you can go and you can meet the candidates. Those are always fun nights. Parties also have to attract and keep voters, because if they have no voters, they have no existence. Parties also engage in research and strategy. What are the issues? What are the talking points? Parties often also serve as a bridge between those people in office and those running for office. And of course, last but not least, media relations. You know what I love doing? It cracks me up. And you all have the ability to see it. On any given day, flip through the cable news channels, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. And you will see, you know, the Republican representative or the Democrat representative. And they will go on, they'll be invited on to talk about a particular issue. And often they will say the exact damn thing. Because what the parties do is they issue position statements. They issue talking points. And so they put people on TV to echo those. Because that's how they think they're going to get their message across.
Does cable news really have an audience anymore?
Not really. Fox does. Fox News has a good size audience.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think on any given time slot, I think they average about 5 to 6 million viewers. Some more, some less. But yeah, MSNBC, CNN are basically dead.
Yeah. Because I can't imagine that, like, they're going to keep funding. I know that they get a ton of money from PACs. I mean, for that makes up a good portion of their funding. I can't imagine that's going to continue.
From what I understand, NBC is thinking about severing or discontinuing MSNBC.
Yeah.
Because they're losing money. I mean, on there's some shows that I've seen, the Nielsen ratings, that there's maybe 40,000 viewers.
Yeah.
It's unsustainable. All right, so that's what I got left on parties. I got 15 minutes left. Just going to give you a brief, some stuff on interest groups. Skip ahead. Interest groups, I've defined that for you last class.
These are basically voluntary associations of people who have common interests. And they use their commonality to kind of influence government. So, the example that I gave last class is my participation as a member of the Sons of the American Legion. So I volunteer, I'm part of a group that exists to help veterans. So we report our numbers to the national organization, and they literally go to DC and they lobby before Congress to try to get Congress to pass bills to support veterans' causes. All right. What are the framers' view of interest groups? Well, they understood that different groups of people have different interests. Obviously, if you're a farmer, you want government to do things differently than if you work in a factory. If you live in a city, obviously you want government to do things differently than if you lived in the suburbs or the country. The Founding Fathers understood that. So to a degree, they wanted people to be able to pursue those interests. Because if you're not allowed to pursue happiness, then you don't actually live in a free society. So if you want to gather together, freely associate, as a group that advocates for senior citizens, or for low-income housing, or for people of special needs, you as a citizen have the right to do that. 100%. But they also recognized two critical issues. One, if you want something that I'm against, that could result in a clash. So for instance, if you want to advocate for the right to smoke pot wherever in the world you are, well, guess what? You're clashing with me. I think pot smoke smells like crap. I don't want to smell your dope. So whose rights wins? Your right to smoke or my right not to smell your smoke? Well, I'll tell you, with cigarettes, the people who were against the smell of smoke won in Massachusetts. Cigarette smokers are treated like freaking lepers. I say this as a longtime smoker, although I quit 20 years ago. I started smoking when I was 12. I smoked all the way up until 2005. And why did I do it? Well, I could see what was happening. I mean, when I was at UMass, that's where I started my undergrad, and then I transferred to Worcester State, you actually could just go outside of the classroom into the hall and smoke. I'm sure the same thing was here. In fact, one of my professors used to bum cigarettes off me all the time. He used to piss me off. I'm like, Professor Kane, am I going to get extra points on my exam for this? He's like, no, bastard. But then Massachusetts banned indoor smoking. And then suddenly had to go outside. They also banned smoking in like bars and clubs.
You used to be able to smoke on airplanes.
You used to be able to smoke on airplanes, right. You used to be able to smoke in restaurants. They had smoking sections, non-smoking sections. Now, I don't even think you're allowed to smoke on campus, right? Don't you have to go off? You have to go out on the sidewalks? Well, I know, they don't really enforce it. But technically, you're not supposed to. The campus is smoke-free.
I'd rather walk through a cloud of cigarette smoke than vape clouds.
Yeah, with all those those plastics that are in there. And yeah, exactly. All right, so one, your rights versus my rights. Clash. Problem number two, what happens if most people are for something, but the minority is against it? Does the majority get to trample the rights of the minority? Something to contemplate. Madison actually talked about interest groups in Federalist Number 10. He said, among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed union, none deserves to be more accurately developed than the tendency to break the control in violence of faction. Factions. The Founding Fathers were very, very concerned with organized interest groups. They referred to them as factions. Because factions have a natural tendency to divide the people. To quote Madison again, a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. If you're pushing for something because you believe in it, could it actually cause harm to the community as a whole? You have a right to pursue what you want, but do you have a right to impose your will upon others? The Founding Fathers recognized you can't stop people from believing in things. But you can kind of put boundaries around their ability to impose their will upon people. So the system itself was designed to check factions. So, small factions could be outvoted. You know, if you're for changing all of the streets to the color blue, because you're part of the blue party. Well, if the vast majority of people don't want the blue party, they're just going to vote against it. And you're going to lose, even if you like blue. But what happens if it's a majority? Well, our republic, the constitutional itself, system itself, can countermand majority positions. Because again, in a democracy, the majority would have the right to completely eliminate the minority. So what is best? Well, the Founding Fathers ultimately argued the best position is the position that goes to the common good. Or another way of phrasing it is, what works in the public interest. So, for example, I may not want my property taxes to go up to support a new school. But maybe the majority of the voters feel that it's in the interest of the community to make sure that kids are in facilities that can assist in the educational process. Although I've never heard of a building actually teaching kids, but you know, people vote. People vote. Happened in our town. Voted for a new high school, middle school. Because the buildings, the old high school was built in 49 and the middle school was built in the 50s. They were not maintained. They were allowed to basically fall apart. And so the people voted for it, and my property taxes went up. Now, the irony is when I voted against it, I had kids in the school system. I just didn't want my property taxes to go up, but I lost. So did I go out and try blowing up the school? No. I simply accepted it, and I moved on. Ultimately, the Founding Fathers believed that the vast majority of people are reasonable like that. Okay, I may be against something, but if I lose the ballot, c'est la vie, move on to the next issue. The problem is, in many ways, Madison was naive. Meaning, the one thing he never realized, that in modern times, with social media, with the courts, with the old media, interest groups can actually seem like they have more power and influence than they actually do. So, again, not trying to be controversial. I'm not saying this to offend anybody. I'm just using it as an example. You go back a couple of years, and the transgender issue seemingly was everywhere, and it had infused itself in all areas of politics. The truth of the matter is that the percentage of people in our country who are transgender are a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent.
But yet it was a big issue. How many guys or boys, you know, playing girls' sports because they identify as a girl? There might have been a dozen, if maybe 20, 30, I don't know, not many. But it was everywhere. It was on TV. It seemed like this was the next big issue. But what has happened since? Most of the people basically decided, yeah, a person can go and be whatever they want to be as an adult, but it's not a good idea to allow men into women's spaces. It's not a good idea to allow boys playing against girls in sports. So the vast majority of people kind of like against it. Now, did they go out and they commit violence? Did they come out and go and protest? No, they simply just sat back and voted. So you had a small issue that reached the level of national politics. But then as time went on, it subsided. How did it get so big? Well, they had activists. They were organized. They also spent huge sums of money. They aligned themselves with politicians. Joe Biden. Last Easter, again, I'm a Catholic. I'm not necessarily like a super Catholic. I'm a traditional American Catholic. But last Easter, if you recall, Joe Biden, the President of the United States, did not recognize Easter. He had Trans Recognition Day at the White House. Why was it so big? Again, Biden was sympathetic. Biden supported the cause. Well, what happens if the majority of people just kind of put their heads down and went along with it? Well, there are states that are imposing laws that could punish you, that could fine you, that could arrest you if you don't subscribe to those ideas. So, Madison believed that the bad influences could be checked by a majority. But the truth be told is, in a modern sense, it's not as easy to do. So today, in the modern sense, because of technology and communication and all the rest, small factions are often as dangerous as large factions. So, essentially, I don't know why that's in there. What's that? And don't skip. I'll skip that. Actually, I'm like out of time. That sucks. All right. I'm going to give you some guidance real quick. Skip that. All right. In your book, there is the discussion of the different types of interest groups. Go into the bureaucracy chapter. Get an understanding of what each of these ones are. And also, this is self-explanatory, get an understanding of what the interest groups do. So just to put it on the recording, because I know not everybody uses the outline, but profit sector groups, you know, are groups that represent, you know, companies that are for profit. Nonprofit companies. Public sector, these are like government unions and so forth. Mixed sector, there are some interest groups that are coalitions of for-profit and nonprofit. There are citizens groups. You know, you have a right to organize whatever group you want. Some of them are civil rights, some of them are, you know, for consumers. There's a whole bunch of different interest groups out there. Just kind of understand what those are. And here, what does interest groups do? Well, the big ones are the dots. They share information, they lobby, they participate in the decision-making process. Sometimes they form coalitions to help with candidates over the top. Sometimes they sue, but this is a big one. They form political action committees, and they funnel money into the campaigns of candidates who support their causes. And of course, they always can take to the street and protest. So I'm going to go home. I got to go on a Zoom call for a little bit this morning. As soon as I'm done with that, I got to re-record the bureaucracy stuff. I'll keep it as simple as I can, and that bureaucracy will make up the last bit of your final. Your final will be online again. I'm going to schedule it for Monday, 1 week from today, because that's when it's supposed to take place. So just like the other three exams, I'll open it up at 8 o'clock in the morning. It will stay open until 11:59 p.m., end of day, and you can take the exam at any point over the day that you want. All right? Do me a favor, though, and of course, the two people who are always, well, you missed an exam, too, but you had a good excuse. Try to take it that day, because I have to submit my grades on Tuesday. So if you don't take it, I'm going to have to give you an F on the exam, which means you might end up with an F on the final. I will send an email out, a message out today, just kind of laying it all out, just to remind you who are here and those who are not.
We don't have class with them?
No, your finals start on Wednesday, don't they?
Yeah. So, they start tomorrow.
Oh, they start tomorrow?
Yeah, Tuesday, Thursday classes have their last days last week.
Oh, well, I got one extra day to do that. So, last thoughts, we covered a lot. Political science is not an easy class to teach. But hopefully, again, you learned a couple of things. And at the end of the day, I don't care if I like converted you to my line of thinking. In fact, I did not want you to do that at all. But hopefully, I just made you more aware that politics, it's a game, and do your best to see the forest for the trees. If you do that, it'll make more sense over the rest of your life. Best of luck to y'all. Hopefully, at some point, our paths will cross again. And if not, take care.